Amid COVID-19 fears, leaders are ratcheting up restrictions, changing life in South Florida. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Governor DeSantis has banned visitations to many senior homes. The number of cases in Florida is growing, but is the testing keeping up with the demand? Also,
the way to flatten a curve is to reduce the number of people, and that's what reproductive number is about, the number of people that get infected from each person that has the disease.
Dr. Eileen Marty knows infectious diseases. She's worked with the government to battle Ebola and the Zika scares. She believes we, as a country, need to do all that we can to flatten the curve of new infections, and she'll explain the best strategies. Finally, Florida's primary is still on for tomorrow. We're going to hear from voters about their candidate. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. The COVID-19 is radically changing life in South Florida and across the globe. I mean, this is a time when spring breakers would be out partying and we'd have a lot of tourists in Wynwood and we'd be at games and events and concerts. And even bars are closing early. Governor Ron DeSantis barred all visitors to nursing homes over the weekend, one of the most vulnerable populations to this virus. Now, there are a confirmed 137 cases in Florida as of this 1 p.m. broadcast. But as testing becomes more widespread, that number is expected to increase drastically. The Miami Herald's healthcare reporter Ben Konark joined us earlier to talk about this. So, Ben, Governor Ron DeSantis spoke over the weekend about a number of drastic measures that the state is taking to reduce the spread of COVID-19. But what was his argument behind barring all visitors to nursing homes?
Well, I mean, I think the argument is the same here as it is in other places, which is just who is most susceptible to developing the most severe symptoms from this disease. You have different groups of people who fall under that category. One of them being people who are over the age of 65 and especially people over the age of 80. And then the other group is people with underlying health conditions. So as you can imagine, nursing homes, assisted living facilities have a lot of those people. So, they're really taking all the precautions they possibly can to make sure that this virus doesn't get into these facilities either through a visitor or through staff members.
What are the resources right now that are being made available to ensure that hospitals and long-term care facilities are prepared if cases begin to emerge?
Well, I think specifically for hospitals, which is a focus of mine, they are not waiting too much for the state to give them resources. Especially the public hospitals down here in South Florida. We have Jackson and Miami-Dade, Broward Memorial, Broward Health. These are public hospitals that have been preparing for something like this for quite some time. So they have their own resources, their own plans, and they're really handling it in many cases kind of as entities themselves. Now, Jackson and UM is an interesting example because they have a very close relationship and they've really banded together in this moment. And I think, people in Miami should take some comfort in the fact that we have the largest public hospital in the Southeast. So they do have a lot of capability to deal with, a pandemic like this. Now, that doesn't mean that we should take it any less seriously. We need to do everything we can and be responsible to make sure that we don't overwhelm these hospitals.
Do we know how many testing kits are now available in the state?
We're hearing updates on this, but it's been a problem for quite some time, for weeks. And, at the outset of this whole pandemic, or when it was still just an epidemic, we were told that tests were coming and they just never came. We have seen an increase in testing recently, and we're expecting that to continue. And the state has reiterated all along that there are no issues with capacity, but a lot of that was, kind of semantics, because when you restrict who you're testing so much, you're not going to have concerns with capacity. But that criteria of who we're now testing for coronavirus has also expanded. So what we're going to see now, especially in this week, as private labs come online and they also do testing, and hospitals might at some point get the ability to test this week, we're going to see more cases confirmed, but that's not necessarily something that should alarm everyone. What that means is that we're testing more people and we're getting a better idea of what we're actually dealing with here.
And what's the governor's plan to get more test kits available for the state?
Well, you know, we're constantly checking in on his plan. I mean, he's ordered more kits from commercial providers. There's developments coming out of the federal government about potential support that they could be providing to the states. We've seen the National Guard set up in Broward County, and they have plans to set up a mobile testing site. So this is just a situation that's developing, constantly right now. But the state's doing everything it can. I mean, everything it can. It recognizes that the testing is a huge part of this because you can't fight what you can't see.
So where can people go if they want to get tested for coronavirus in South Florida?
You know, that's one of the biggest issues that we're going to face as a country as we deal with this pandemic is that we don't have a public health system like a lot of the other countries that have been affected by this virus. So it really is a question that every individual has to answer on their own, which is not great in a situation like this. For instance, if you have private health insurance and you have a primary care provider and you feel like you might have symptoms or might have coronavirus, you're going to want to call that office and tell them and get guidance from them. Or you can call your county health department. If you don't have insurance, that's a tougher question. You call the county health department and you follow their guidance and whatever they tell you is what you should end up doing.
So under what circumstances should individuals be going to these sites to be tested?
Well, these testing sites that have been announced or have not actually been established yet, so we don't know a whole lot about them. We can look at how they work in other states, but we're not sure if that's how they're going to work here. We know of one in Fort Myers where you need a doctor's order and to meet certain criteria to show up. So it's not like a Wendy's where you just roll up and you say, "Can I be please tested for coronavirus?" It's still going to be ordered by physicians. Now that could change in the next day. I mean, the HHS has said that they want to dramatically expand drive-through testing, but we just don't know what that's going to look like yet.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's health reporter, Ben Konark. Governor Ron DeSantis announced a number of testing sites being set up throughout South Florida and is providing assistance from the National Guard in some of the hardest hit areas. We have a live blog of our coverage. Just go to WLRN.org. So, Ben, what support is the National Guard providing right now during the pandemic?
Well, that's still something that we're going to see, but they're in Broward County right now, which tells us a lot about what health officials suspect might be going on in Broward County. Keep in mind, some of the first cases in the state were confirmed in Broward County, and then, over the weekend, we saw numbers just spike there. For a while, the governor was saying that there was no evidence of community spread, and it seems very clear now that community spread is happening, perhaps in other parts of the state, but most certainly in Broward County, where a number of cases have come up with no connections to travel or other cases. So Broward County is really emerging as kind of a hotspot for this virus. So what the National Guard is going to do is they're going to come in, they're going to provide support that could just be in the form of testing, but depending on how this goes and what we see at the hospitals in Broward County, there may have to be a situation where we see them actually set up a field hospital. So again, it's a fluid situation, and we don't know exactly what the National Guard's role is going to be right now, but certainly having their support in Broward County can't hurt.
And you've been tracking the number of cases in Florida and posting them on an interactive map on the Miami Herald's website. Besides Broward County, where are some of the other bad spots?
Well, we're seeing cases start to accelerate here in Miami, Miami-Dade County, that is. We're seeing cases really all over the state. Northeast Florida is now seeing its cases. Cases have been on the West Coast for quite some time now in the Tampa area. Cases in the Panhandle. I mean, this is the thing, right? So what we're seeing is everything on a delay. There's people traveling to all parts of the state from all parts of the world, and this virus is just so transmissible that it doesn't recognize boundaries or borders. It goes wherever it's taken, and it spreads very quickly. So we should assume as a state that it's everywhere right now. And what we're seeing as far as numbers and symptoms and patients, that's all on a delay. That's 5 to 8 days ago. That's when those people were exposed. So we have to understand that we are in a situation where we're kind of driving and the headlights are kind of dim, and we can only see a few feet in front of us.
What have been the challenges you know, with regards to getting accurate information from the state?
Well, you know, it's been an ongoing situation with the state where they've changed how they deliver this information. For a while, they were updating us in the middle of the day, and then they started updating us in the middle of the night. All the reporters in Florida have been having fluctuating sleeping schedules who are covering this. I mean, it's just, we are told that there are going to be regular updates going forward at noon and 6 p.m., and we are told that a new website is being developed to make this a more seamless process, but clearly disseminating information to a very concerned public has been a challenge for the Department of Health and the governor's office so far.
And what have you been hearing from your readers about their biggest concerns, what they want to know, if they're taking it serious?
I think our readers are taking it very seriously, and you know, I think that that's something that should be commended. And you know, I know that I'm a WLRN listener myself, and I know you all have been providing great coverage for your listeners. I think this is a time for us all to just be paying attention and doing what we can. You might not think that you are at great risk yourself, but you could know someone who then takes care of their parent or their grandparent, and that person could then get the virus from you. No one wants that on their conscience, right? We should all be taking steps to protect each other. So as far as, you know, what kind of feedback we've been hearing, I think the testing is on top of everyone's mind, because it's that uncertainty. How do I get tested? When do I get tested? Where do I get tested? These are all questions that we haven't had clear answers for, and we probably should have had those answers weeks ago. We're far behind other countries. Other questions really focus about what is this disease? What does it do? And that, unfortunately, we still don't have a lot of clarity on. This is a brand new emerging virus, so we're still learning about how it behaves and you know, all the questions associated with that.
Yeah. Your colleague Taylor Dolvin reported recently how passengers got off a cruise ship recently without being tested. Do we know the protocols that the state has for, you know, for getting off of cruise ships, for cruise ships in general?
Yeah, you know, that Taylor has been doing amazing coverage on the various cruise ships that have had passengers test positive for coronavirus. I do not know which authority made that decision as to whether these ships can disembark. But, you know, this is something that may be coming from the federal authorities. I don't think the state plays a role in that, but we, you know, we've seen in other situations where the federal authorities are really telling cruise ships whether they can disembark or where they can dock and those kinds of decisions.
We've been talking with the Miami Herald's health reporter, Ben Konark. We have a live blog of our coverage. Just go to WLRN.org. Ben, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
By the way, if you're a parent who's now at home with your kids or an educator, we want to hear from you. How are your employers responding to COVID-19 in South Florida? You can contact WLRN's Nadege Green at ngreen@wlrnnews.org. Again, that's ngreen@wlrnnews.org. Two N's. Well, still to come, we're going to hear from the FIU doctor who helped the U.S. battle Ebola. She has thoughts on how to battle COVID-19. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. While health officials are telling us to engage in social distancing, we are encouraged to avoid crowds and stay at home as much as possible. Now, one thing is for sure, we have to do a lot to keep this coronavirus from infecting millions. We recently spoke with Dr. Eileen Marty, a physician in the fields of infectious disease and disaster response at the FIU Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine. Dr. Marty's a physician with 40 years of experience in infectious disease spread. Now, she played a critical role in the Ebola outbreak in Africa and the Zika spread here in South Florida. Now, she wants to share with people those things that we need to do to protect each other. I want to talk about an expression we've been hearing a lot, reducing the curve of the virus. What does that mean?
What we're talking about with the curve, so this is, you know, gumshoe epidemiology stuff, is that we measure the rise of cases, right? So that's that curve. And we compare what that rise of cases is if we let things happen as Mother Nature would have them happen. With something, this infection, that rise is very steep. And that means a lot more cases, a lot more use of ICU space, and a lot more deaths. If we flatten the curve, that means that we are employing those tools at our disposition in order to get the total number of people that get infected to be lower, that's bringing it down, and also that the numbers per unit time get lower so that we can manage whoever does get sick and that we don't run out of equipment, beds, and everything else.
When you saw the way China was handling it at the beginning and how that evolved, and then South Korea, what were they doing to bring down that curve?
China did not wake up to the reality that they had a massive problem until the end of December, at which point they realized that they needed to follow the international health regulations, which every country, including the U.S., that's a member state of the United Nations, signed, which explains what each country's responsibility is for an important outbreak. At that time, it was just an outbreak. And becoming quickly an epidemic in Wuhan and in Hubei province. What the Chinese decided to do in the beginning of January is to report everything they could. In fact, just yesterday I had an email from China from one of my Chinese colleagues. He's very proud of what they managed to do. Basically, they published every single thing they could. They instigated the various things that have to be instigated to reduce what's called the reproductive number. Because the way to flatten a curve is to reduce the number of people, and that's what reproductive number is about, the number of people that get infected from each person that has the disease.
They were separating families. Those who were, you know, found to have this coronavirus, and isolating them from everybody else. Some people had said, though, that the Chinese method was a little draconian. But is that really the only way?
Problem is, you employ the tools you have. That's really the bottom line. If we had a vaccine, which we do not have and will not have for very optimistically a year and a half, and I assure you that's very optimistic for this virus, they knew they had to use the other methods available at hand to reduce the reproductive number. And I think it might be a good time to go over what that reproductive number entails and what the different things are.
You have an equation here, is that when you have a patient, a person with the virus, how many people they might be infecting within that certain amount of time, which, by the way, because we hear so many numbers, like how long a person has it, how many, you know, how long that incubation period is, and so forth. I mean, it gets confusing. And a lot of people feel confused right now.
This is a common human enemy. And one of the things is we need to increase our love of science and mathematics, certainly in our country, but many other countries as well. We should love science and math just as much as we love sports. If we do that, then this becomes super, super simple. But I think it's still simple, even if you aren't a big fan of science and math. So what we're doing here is we're talking about the R-naught or the R-zero. Okay, what the heck is that? That's just the symbol that we have for the person and how much that person, if you do nothing, how many other people they're going to infect. So if you do nothing, you have an R-zero or an R-naught. And then there are four parameters that we look at. The first one is how long are they shedding enough virus to infect somebody else? And that's what we call the duration. The second thing is, what is the opportunity for that person shedding virus to infect somebody else? And that means how close they are to other people. And we think about that as the contact rate, okay? The next thing is the transmission probability. What is the probability that if I'm next to someone who has this virus that I'll actually catch it from them? And that has to do with whether or not that person is speaking or coughing or shedding virus around the spaces I am, or if I put my hand in contact with that material that somebody who has the virus has inadvertently shed, and then touch my mucous membranes. And by that, I mean my mouth, my nose, my eyes. And so the third thing is how susceptible I am as a host to manifesting disease. How likely am I to get sick because I have that virus in my body? And so that's when we talk about how old you are and whether or not you have high blood pressure.
How healthy you are.
How healthy you are, exactly.
So when I look at this and going all the way through, if we do nothing, that each person could be infecting 2 to 4 people?
Those are the current estimates, 2 to 4 people. It may actually be higher than that.
Ever since the World Health Organization made the announcement that this was a pandemic, from that point on, it was a domino effect. We started to see all sports leagues basically now have canceled, major events, all big events. Would you say that that's the right thing to do?
So if you look at the duration of the infectious period, which is our first number, the easiest way to limit the number of days that you're shedding virus would be to do one of two things, neither of which we have.
Because it requires medicine we don't have.
It requires a vaccine and an antiviral that we don't have. So we can't work on that. So that means we're left with the other three. What can we do about the other three? Well, if you look over here, you've got your opportunity or your contact rate. That's why we're limiting mass gatherings, so that we limit the contact rate. We also limit the time that you're near somebody who's infectious. Another thing that's going to decrease that opportunity. You do your hand hygiene. You do your surface hygiene. You're limiting that contact rate, that opportunity for contracting the virus, right? And if you're in a hospital setting, you also add personal protective equipment, which we had to use in Ebola and we have to use to some extent here.
We're talking with Dr. Eileen Marty from Florida International University. She's an infectious disease expert with 40 years of experience in coordinating the U.S. response to infectious outbreaks like Zika and Ebola. Now, you can find a live blog of our updated coverage of COVID-19 at WLRN.org. You were telling it to me this way. It's like you think about it, whether we're coughing or sneezing, even talking, we are spitting. And so in that saliva, that virus can survive for quite a while.
You're right, because in the saliva, the virus has stabilizers that help it survive. It has salts, it has mucin, it has some sugars. I mean, it's very happy. As long as you have that human element that's helping it can survive on surfaces for days.
So that, you know, that's why people are now going out and buying a lot of these disinfectant wipes, disinfectants, period.
It's right to do so, although I think people are forgetting that this is 2020 and not 1820.
So that's, again, limiting contact. That's one of the other three, the transmission probability. How can we do that?
Now, this is the most important thing that we're not doing, and that they did do in China, and that they did do in Korea, and that they did do in Singapore, and that's why they are flattening their curves. Have enough tests so that there's certainty. That means you test everyone, not just the most severely ill, not just the most critical, but the people who have moderate and mild disease as well. Isolate them and treat them after you triage them, and then you have to check all their contacts. That means every member of their family, everyone they've been close to since the time that they may have contracted the virus, and those people have to be tested too. So the no handshaking.
Okay.
All right? That's about the transmission probability. The elbow bumps is all about keeping enough distance that the chance for a transmission is down. Let's say that I were within 9 feet of an infected person, which is further away than is likely for me to get infected. It's still not zero. right? Especially if I then move into the space where he was and touch some contaminated surface and touch my face, right, without having cleaned myself beforehand. So it's not zero, and therefore it's important to have some level of social distancing.
So that we can do.
Oh, yeah.
That part we can do. It's what's the last one? And what can we do?
The last one is our susceptibility, our likelihood of getting sick if that virus enters our body. And remember, the dose makes the poison, right? So when you have, and that's also true for the social distancing. So if I only encounter one little viral particle, the odds are my body can handle that without ever getting sick. If I encounter all at once thousands of versions of the virus, then I have to have a stronger immune system to keep myself from getting sick.
So if I'm healthy, I have a better chance?
If you're healthy, you have a better chance. If you get a smaller dose, you get a better chance. Those are two things that have to do with this susceptibility thing in a way. But so what are the things that you can do to make yourself more healthy? If you have comorbidities, make sure they're treated. So if you have hypertension, if you have cardiovascular disease, if you have respiratory problems, if you have cancer or diabetes, make sure that those things are as controlled as they can be. And if you don't, or even if you do, you still have to do the three most important things we all should be doing all the time. Eat nutritious foods in healthy quantities, not too much, not too little. Get a good night's sleep and exercise every day. And by exercise, you don't have to go to the gym. You just have to make sure your body gets a little bit of that exercise. Just walk a little bit further.
Be a little more physically active.
Yeah, don't sit around all day.
Some of these things we can control. I can walk more, I can eat healthier, okay. But, you know, we see, for example, people who are a little older are more susceptible. That's just, you know, nothing you can do about that. If you're a little older, you're a little older. You have some of those issues. Those are they could be a challenge.
That's true, but laugh.
Okay.
It's good. It's good for your immune system. And do whatever you do that decreases your stress.
Now, so I'm going to push back on you here. So I'm looking at this and saying, some of these we don't have. We're not doing enough testing. We don't have a vaccine yet. Is it enough to get to, you know, just can we get that number of the possibility of how many people we're infecting down to what you have there? Can we get that to minus one, below one?
We did it with Ebola. We can do it with this. If people, but to do it, the most important thing is we have to do it together. And what I mean by that is each individual, each family, each business, each school has to take responsibility. Each level of government has to be united, and it's and not just our country, but every country has to be taken into consideration. The reason that the World Health Organization declared this a public health emergency of international concern back at the end of January was the concern that there were countries whose resources wouldn't allow them to take the necessary steps that we've just talked about. These three areas, the opportunity area, the transmission area, and the susceptibility that we do have tools for, that they didn't have the resources to do it. The reason they called it a pandemic a couple of days ago, which they could have done several weeks ago, if you look at what a textbook meaning of pandemic is because they recognized something that was breaking my heart. And that is that countries that did have the resources, that knew what the international health regulations state, weren't doing them, weren't taking this seriously enough. So they didn't use the word pandemic before because people associate it with Hollywood and they get all scared, and that's not what we want. They used it now to wake up those governments that were treating this as if it were not a serious condition, that weren't recognizing it.
That's to wake up governments, but then you just said it. That word goes out. What's your concern about how people, the average person, takes the word pandemic and how they're defining it?
Right. So let's get that science education in everybody's head. The word pandemic comes out of basic epidemiology, all right? So what we're talking about, when something starts in a country that is with numbers higher than the background, that's an outbreak. When it goes beyond the capabilities in a nation, okay, it's an epidemic. When there's more than one country that has the same epidemic, it's already a pandemic by definition. And we had that a long time ago. And that's a low-level pandemic if it's in the same continent. Once you see it in two or more continents on Earth, it's a global pandemic by definition. And we had that back when Italy started showing so many community-acquired cases. So it's about the community-acquired cases that are out of a chain that we know of. Right? And that it's an outbreak and not just a cluster of cases.
Again, though, the word just seems to hold it a fear.
Because people don't understand that the word is about geography and not about the level of risk. So we often have things that are pandemic that we in public health have learned not to use the word because Hollywood has turned it into something that's always frightening. It's not frightening in and of itself. It's just about geography. That's all it is.
You've been hearing Dr. Eileen Martin, infectious disease expert. Now, the Florida Department of Emergency Management is scheduled to carry a press conference at 3:00 today to discuss the response from the state. And the White House Task Force to Address the Coronavirus Response will be holding another press conference at 3:30, and we will carry live coverage of both conferences here on WLRN. In just a few minutes, we'll get back to our conversation with Dr. Marty. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Eileen Marty about COVID-19. Again, she's a physician in the fields of infectious disease and disaster response at FIU.
I'd imagine the big cities are more at risk than smaller communities, again, because of the number of people. But you think about communities like ours, I mean, South Florida, again, especially Miami being a major international city, a big port city. Is there a greater concern here, again, because of the connections that we have with Europe and with especially Latin America?
Yeah. This is a time when we need strong leaders to act and do what's in the best interest of our nation, and not only of our own nation, but you saw that what Congress passed recently, the first budget, and they're about to announce a second one, included money for other countries as USAID, and that's important. We have to be good neighbors because there are countries that would want to implement those tools that we have and don't have the wherewithal to do it, and if we don't help our neighbor, their problems become our problems. So it's absolutely fundamental.
It's not to get political, but I'm talking about leaders, whether we're talking from the White House to the governor's mansion to our mayors, you know, the message that you're hearing, is it right or is there something missing?
There are some leaders at certain levels of government that are doing the best they can, that have recognized the depth and breadth of this problem, that are beginning to understand what a One Health disease is. So a One Health disease is a disease that affects people, animals, the environment, which this clearly does, is affected by the social determinants of health, which means whether or not you have access to health care, for example, right? And impacts significantly on the economy. So COVID-19 is your classic one health disease. If you start to understand what that really means, you'll understand that when people get sick, it has an economic impact first on the individual, next on their family, then on their community, and it has social impacts on all those people. And if there's enough sick people and you start draining the resources of hospitals, then you have a major impact on the economy. So flattening the curve is not just about the health problems. It's about our economy. It's about our entire health.
And you know, and again, wealth. Coming back to this idea that, you know, isolating people in that equation and trying to prevent the spread, do travel bans work? You know, because we've seen the travel ban now on Europe, but should we have it? There's a push to have a travel ban on Cuba, parts of the Caribbean. Should we have travel ban on parts of South America? Does it work?
It's so naive. It really is. It's at the beginning, when this thing was pretty much only in China, then a travel ban could give us time to get ready. But we needed to get serious. We needed to recognize that viruses don't recognize borders and that we have an interconnected global world. We had the time, we squandered it.
As you said before, it'd be hopeful, but probably not a year and a half before we come close to any kind of vaccine?
It would be unbelievably optimistic if we actually had a vaccine in a year and a half. Even though right now there's active production of many vaccines throughout the world, not just the United States, of different ideas of how to make the vaccine, etc. And we do have the good fortune of having learned from SARS and MERS about beta coronaviruses. But people don't know some fundamental things about beta coronaviruses. And that is that every virus that is for which we are a host needs to try and survive. So every virus uses whatever tricks it has to in its toolbox to evade our immune system. The flu, its favorite trick is to camouflage, to change its outer surface so that our immune system says, oh, that's something new, and starts all over again with trying to produce the right cells and the right antibodies to the new version of flu that's out there. But flu, relative to corona, is tiny. Corona is a big RNA virus with a lot of extra genes. And these coronaviruses, especially the beta coronaviruses, do something to the immune system. For example, there's a feline infectious peritonitis, and SARS both have this feature. They have something called antibody-enhanced infection. And what the heck is that? Well, antibody-enhanced infection means that they use the antibodies that our bodies make to try and protect ourselves to latch on to the cells that are supposed to chew it up. And instead of getting chewed up, they expand their numbers. And that's
it's what, turning our system on us.
It's turning our most important, our adaptive immune system against us. So when we tried to make a SARS vaccine in the beginning, way back when we thought we would need one, what happened was that the initial version, because of this trick, when it was given to the experimental animals that we tried it on that were of similar immune system to ours, because that's a really important feature, it actually made the animals sicker if they had that particular. We have to have a vaccine that is safe, and we can. We know how to make safe vaccines. We make safe vaccines for other kinds of viruses that use different kinds of tricks. But we have to have a safe vaccine that provides a level of immunity that's worth doing, and that takes time. It takes time.
I'm speaking with Dr. Eileen Marty at Florida International University. She's an infectious disease expert with 40 years of experience in coordinating the U.S. response to infectious outbreaks like Zika and Ebola. You can find a live blog of our updated coverage of COVID-19 at WLRN.org. We got a couple of questions from listeners. These are some of the things that are on their mind right now. This one came from a listener on Instagram. Why aren't we aggressively testing folks in the hospitality industry?
At this time, we don't have enough test kits to test people who have mild symptoms. People who are contacts are not being tested. We simply do not have the wherewithal to do what we should be doing.
Here's another one that we got. This one from Google Form. If a person is in good physical shape, how likely are they to get the virus?
So let's distinguish getting the virus from getting sick. That last part of the equation, the susceptibility, has to do with whether you get sick from encountering the virus. It doesn't matter how healthy you are. If we don't do the measures we need to get, we know 75% of the population is going to get the virus in their body. But the outcome of that is changed by making yourself healthy to the extent that you can.
Here's another one that's come up. Can pets get it?
So, again, coronaviruses are the first coronavirus we ever found was actually in a chicken. And there are coronaviruses of all kinds of birds. There are coronaviruses of many kinds of mammals. And there are known coronaviruses of dogs and cats. But that said, we haven't, except for one instance in Hong Kong, found this coronavirus doing anything to any dog or cat. So at this time, without any additional mutations or changes by this virus, it doesn't look like it causes problems in our pets. But it could change. That's one problem. And the second problem is we don't know, and we need to do these studies, because we only have 11 weeks of knowing about this virus. So we haven't had the time to figure out whether dogs and cats can harbor the virus and not get sick. So that's why we're asking people who are self-isolating to separate themselves from their pets.
And that leads to this other question that we did get, this one from Facebook. If you're self-isolating, what are they asking us to do? Just stay away from everybody and everything?
Of course, you have to consider who you live with and whether you can have a separate bathroom for the person who's self-isolating from everyone else. And you know, if you're in one room that has a bathroom and that's your space for 2 weeks, food and so forth should be left on your door of that room, and the other people should be, at least 6 feet away when you open the door, and when the food comes out, you should wipe it down inside the room as best as possible, and they should hold it with gloves, and wipe it down again. So that's the level that we're dealing with here.
Now, you know, we talked about testing and not enough testing, but the other question that keeps popping up is about hospitals and how prepared they are to take in patients. Do we know if hospitals have stockpiled on their supplies, that they have enough, if in case this happens? I mean, we saw what China did. They built a hospital. They built places to isolate people. But are hospitals ready for this?
People who are severe and critical have to be in an ICU for 2 to 6 weeks. And in very unpleasant conditions that they have to do, because we're breathing for them, and we have to lay them on their chest, because we have to paralyze them. So they're paralyzed for 2 weeks in an ICU with low volume ventilation. Okay, so and they feel like they're suffocating because that low volume protects their lungs from getting injured by our attempts to resuscitate them. And while they're in that condition, so they have all this carbon dioxide buildup, even though they're okay, they don't feel okay, and they're paralyzed. And they're there for 2 to 6 weeks, and that has to be at the intensive care level so that we can treat them. And those are the severe cases. The critical is even worse. 2 to 6 weeks. So how much ICU space do we have as surge capacity in this country? Well, we run very close to the margin in our hospitals. Most of our ICUs are at 100% capacity almost all the time. what happens when you start putting in patients? And this is what happened in Italy. This is why they had to triage who they have to triage the way we triage in war. Remember, I was military, where you simply decide that some people you're not going to be able to provide that care for because you've run out of space and materials. That's where we are. And that's why we have to get the testing fixed, and we have to do surveillance, and we have to get on it.
Hearing that, and again, what we know, and this also, you could help me with this too, because as, you know, the messenger, as the disseminator of information in the news media, I want to know what information we should be getting out there to not create the panic, but help people understand what this is and how to go about their lives.
Yeah, and they need to understand this. They need to understand how we get it below one. They need to understand that the travel bans are too little too late at this point, the new ones, you know, because at this point, the house is already infested. Closing one window isn't going to fix the problem. You've got to fix the problem in the house, in this case, in the country. We've got to find every single case, isolate and treat them. That's a fundamental thing.
Dr. Marty, again, it seemed to get you here whenever there's a problem, because we had it here last time with Zika. So hopefully this doesn't last too long.
If we get our act together and follow these precedents, we can get this done with in a very short period of time. If we don't, that curve is going to continue to rise, and our suffering at every level is going to increase.
That was our conversation with Dr. Eileen Marty, a physician in the fields of infectious disease and disaster response at FIU. By the way, our education reporter wants to hear from you as well. Schools across South Florida have gone to remote learning. How is online learning going for you? Is the transition hard? Email WLRN's Jessica Bakeman at jbakeman, B-A-K-E-M-A-N, at WLRNnews.org. And the Florida primaries are still on for tomorrow.
We're definitely voting. I mean, this is they voted during the Civil War. We're going to vote. You know, these primaries, the way this has worked out, I mean, quite frankly, are not going to be cliffhangers.
Well, some polling precincts have been moved. Palm Beach County and Broward County have moved voting away from senior centers to minimize the risk of spreading COVID-19. This year, WLRN and the world have been hearing from young Latinx voters. Latinos are a crucial voting bloc this 2020 presidential election. Nearly every 30 seconds a Latino turns 18, the voting age. Let's hear from some of them.
My name is Daniela Ferreira from Miami, the southwestern part, Redlands area. You know, we can have all of these policy debates. We can have discussions and talk about our differences with regards to healthcare and education and climate change and sea level rise. But if we don't win elections, none of that matters. So step one is defeating Donald Trump, making sure that he's a one-term president. And I believe in my heart that that candidate is Joe Biden.
So my name is Anthony Goyanes. I'm 17, about to turn 18 in March. I'm a first-time voter. I'm a first-generation Latino here. I'm Cuban. Both of my parents are Cuban. I'm planning to vote for President Donald Trump and sort of the Republican local candidates that are, you know, running as well. Issues that matter to me are sort of like transportation, national defense, infrastructure, and economic issues as well.
Angelica Sanchez, I'm from Venezuela, and I'm 25. I'm voting for Bernie because he is a candidate that has been consistent in what he believes in. He's a candidate that is for the people. He really believes in empowering the youth where others do not believe that. And how do you empower the youth? Empower the youth by allowing them free education, by granting them better pay, by granting them ability to go get better health care. You don't support communities by just saying, yeah, we support you.
And again, Florida's presidential primary on for tomorrow. How are you feeling going into tomorrow? Are you afraid of, you know, again, with all of this concern over COVID-19 about going to the polling place? We'd like to hear from you. Text the word VOTE to 305-676-7825. Again, 305-676-7825. Standard messaging rates apply. And by the way, if you go to vote tomorrow, remember to follow the guidelines by the CDC. Bring hand sanitizer, stay 6 feet away from people, wash your hands, don't touch your face. That is Sundial for this Monday, March 16th. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to be taking phone calls. How will COVID-19 impact voter turnout in South Florida? Why is Florida moving forward with scheduled primary dates? Again, as the CDC is telling us, not to go to any place where there are more than 50 people gathered. So we'll find out. We're going to hear from our reporters following the primary. Also, by the way, schools across South Florida closed during the coronavirus outbreak. We want to learn how children are getting access to food and necessary childcare services. And, of course, the decisions in Broward and Palm Beach and Monroe County, with the fact that they're going into spring break. And, you know, how are people getting by? We want to know how people are doing in these times. And, of course, most major concerts have been canceled. How are musicians reaching their fans? By the way, did you know about a studio concert with Juanes? They've got close to 2 million views. All right, all of that coming up tomorrow on the program. Again, we'd love to hear from you. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Stay safe. We'll talk to you tomorrow.